Hi, my name is Mike Gibb, and I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'll be moderating today's webinar on vendor due diligence best practices. Collection agencies must deal with vendor due diligence issues on two separate yet equally important fronts. They must be approved by many of the clients they work with, and they have their own service providers that need to be vetted and approved. In this webinar, a panel of leading collection agency executives will share their best practices to help agencies of all shapes and sizes manage this important component of running a successful operation. This webinar is being generously sponsored by LexisNexis Risk Solutions. You'll get the chance to hear from them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Tracy Dudek is the Chief Operating Officer for State Collection Service, responsible for overseeing the organization's production and support areas, including the company's extended business office and third-party collection divisions, as well as patient engagement, business intelligence, client services, and human resources, among others. Tracy's been involved in the receivables industry for more than 20 years. She's been instrumental in enhancing the technological tools that put State Collection Service ahead of many others in the healthcare receivables space. Additionally, she has played a key role in the growth of State Collection Service's multiple locations. Matt Kiefer is the Chief Officer for Information Development and Compliance for the Preferred Group of Tampa. He is a past president and current vice president and education chair of the Florida Collectors Association. He served on the board for the National Healthcare Collections Association and was a member of HFMA and MGMA and is also an ACA scholar and fellow. He's been in the healthcare and collections space since 2001. He enjoys shooting, MMA, CrossFit, and politics. Paige Tortorich is the Director of Internal Audit at ERC and has more than 15 years of auditing experience and is a current member of ACA International and the Inside Arms Compliance Professionals Forum. She's been an auditor in different industries, but found her home in the vast compliance world of collections, where she spent the last 5 years. She was an external auditor for more than 2 years, conducting remote and on-site audits on third-party collection agencies. Paige's time on both sides of the audit table provides her with the experience to know which audit should be done and why. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everyone to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is an audio only event, so if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing out on anything. And finally, this event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. With that, let's launch into the discussion, and Matt will give you the honor of the first question. Let's ask you, what are some of the reasons why a collection agency should consider switching service providers?
Well, thanks, Mike. I think one of the big things is, for instance, we've experienced vendors not keeping up with technology, competition in the space, the capabilities of your current vendor and its limitations, changing compliance needs, costs, customer service, and just things like general performance.
I agree with everything that Matt said. Another thing is your requirements aren't being met, like your standards of work or SLA requirements. And what we like to do is every year, every other year, just audit your contracts to see if you can renegotiate with that vendor to see if you can lower the price. And it's also important to have a termination clause in your MSA so you can make sure that you can terminate at any time if you do find another vendor that better suits your needs or can provide the same services at a lower price.
And I agree that renegotiating is important as well. We like to look at different providers for new technology and looking at what folks are offering out in the industry that maybe your current service provider may not be offering. So for us, it's been a lot about continuous improvement.
Tracy, let me follow up and ask you, how do you, you know, that's a great idea, sort of always looking for what's new and out there. Is it just a matter of being active and sort of having conversations with service providers? Because sort of how do you know what's available unless somebody tells you it's available, if that makes sense.
Well, we get phone calls, right? But also being out at the trade shows or the industry events and hearing from our peers. We participate in a benchmarking group where we exchange ideas, as well as just keeping up with your electronic newsletters and feeds on a regular basis. So folks know to, you know, after you've been around the industry a while, they know how to find you and your role. And it, you know, it's easy to say, no, I don't want to listen to a sales pitch. But sometimes it's worth taking that 15 to 20 minutes to first just learn what somebody is calling you about. So, I mean, it's hard to sell, and I like to give folks just a few minutes of my time if they're willing to make that phone call or send an email, because I do want to learn about what's out there. Our company uses a process through strategic planning called an innovation meeting. And so we require our leaders once a year to bring and really search out new services or new providers and bring those to our strategic planning team and do presentations. We do 15-minute presentations. And then from that, we decide which ones we want to learn a little bit more about. So we've really made it an active process about doing better. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes we need to switch because another need is not being met. But we've tried to take the stance of we want to improve technology or how we're handling things for the patients or our employees. And so we're challenging our team annually to go out and gather information. And so we get, you know, anywhere from about 25 to 30 new ideas that are partially researched to that innovation meeting. And then we decide which ones we want to dig into further.
And I don't know if that's across the industry, but ERC had a big push this year too in the fourth quarter to present those innovative technologies and how we can better ourselves as a company in this industry and be a leader in that innovation process and the AI processes. I think that's kind of across the board too, that people are really focusing on improving your processes with that innovation and technology.
Would you think that's is that the first step or a first step that you like to take too, Matt, in terms of, doing your due diligence is just sort of always sort of being open to anybody who's looking to sort of not necessarily sell you, but sort of let you know about what's going on with a particular product or service?
Oh, absolutely. ACA Hub's a great source for, vetting new vendors, seeing what other people are doing. You mentioned trade shows, LinkedIn. But also, when you're on LinkedIn, you need to know what your clients' needs are and the things that they're facing, because some of your technology may be applicable to them and can help. So you need to just jump in there and, just mention it, not to sell them on it, but to mention it and see if you can fit a need. That way your client knows that you care.
So it's about sort of taking that information you're getting or taking those decisions that you're making and also making sure that it's flowing through to your clients, almost for that same sort of the mirror image of that conversation you're having with, the service providers who are trying to sell to you.
Absolutely. There's many times I'll recommend a particular vendor that we may use or something, especially if I know a client has a particular need that they can't meet yet. Always bringing information to the table for them to make a good informed decision.
Excellent. So when we're looking at due diligence and when we're looking at, the criteria for selecting a new provider, what would you rank as the top priority at your state, Tracy? Is it price? Is it service? How apply different weights to those different types of criteria that you're looking at?
Mm-hmm. Service is first and price is second. And our CFO would want me to say it's a very close second. But if the service and the partnership isn't there, then everything else doesn't work. We tend to challenge and push the folks that we're partners with. And you can't get that good dialogue if you're not in a true partnership. And so we want to work with folks that are aligned with how we want our patients treated and how our clients are expecting the patients to be treated in all things that we do. And then if it's a provider that is affecting our employees, the same thing. We've got to make sure that the employees are taken care of and their needs are getting met. And, you know, we are about continuous improvement. And so part of that service category in our due diligence is continuing to bring new and fresh ideas to the table, new technology, discussing, you know, what the roadmap is, because you're buying not only what they have available for you today, but you're buying where they're going in the future as a partner. So I, you know, it's been our philosophy that we don't want to change partners every few years unless we absolutely have to. We want to build longstanding partnerships that where people get to know us and they can help us solutions, you know, they solution sell to us. And price is important, and references and, you know, many other things I think we'll get to on this call. But the overall relationship that we have with that service provider is the key.
I agree. I think you can have a great price, but, you know, if you have poor customer service and I'm losing revenue because of it, then the cost savings can be wiped out. Over all the years in this industry, I think some vendors just lose sight of this, especially your big ticket vendors like your mail, your dialer, your collection software vendors. And I've seen the pendulum swing from over-promising and under-delivering. Once the sale is over, there's a short honeymoon period, and then you're left kind of dissatisfied to swinging the other way. We're really going the extra mile with an extended honeymoon phase where the vendor really likes to make you happy and will do whatever it takes to keep you happy. You know, the vendor that goes the extra mile is going to earn my trust, and I'm going to become a raving fan. And any cost savings caused by me pushing the envelope comes back with a bigger ROI to my vendor, to them, because, you know, I'm going to go out of my way to recommend them.
How do you know when you're evaluating a service provider that they're going to be that type of partner, that they're going to have that type of commitment to you, not just for the honeymoon phase, but, you know, after the honeymoon is, you know, quote unquote over? How do you make sure that you're, you know, that you're ensuring that partnership is going to work, you know, for the long term?
Yeah, I think there you have to just really vet them. And, you know, you're gonna have to ask for references, and not just the references they're gonna give you, but, you know, maybe on ACA Hub, you're asking, you know, who are you guys using for problem A or for this, you know, particular type solution? Because then you're gonna find out, you know, people that you're not familiar with, maybe they don't go to your trade shows and stuff, and other people are using them, it might be a good fit. Might not, but it might be a good fit.
We do the same. We rely heavily on the references. And asking the reference, when you do the reference call, asking the questions about, you know, what's the worst experience that you've had, what's a problem that you've had, and then how have they made that problem better? Because, you know, there's going to be issues with every relationship or every, you know, group that you work with, but it's a matter of how you work through them, what ownership do they take when there is a difficult situation, as well as their responsiveness. We did an RFP about 2 years ago and have spent a lot of time on reference calls, not only ones that the vendors themselves gave us, but also to people that we knew in the industry, both our peers and other vendors that would work with that service provider. And, you know, I think we did probably no less than about 12 or 13 reference calls and made a matrix. And, you know, we found out some really good information, and not all the good stuff. We wanted to uncover the worst things we could possibly hear, so we knew going into it what, you know, really what the worst would be, and give that service provider a chance to respond to some of those things. And it was very interesting when we shared information about the things that their customers said they could do better, how they would respond to those. And it just really told you a lot about their integrity and whether they owned the situation or not.
And I agree with all of that. Definitely the references are very important. And we just don't want them to provide two or three references. We want to have a whole list from the vendor, just, you know, so we can pick which ones we want to call. And another thing that we do is we have several people in our company call the vendor because they might have different perspectives. So we might have the executive manager or the ERC business owner who's responsible for that vendor process call and ask their questions. And then our chief compliance officer will call too because he's coming more from a compliance perspective. So we try to make sure all of our bases are covered when we speak with those references. And also we go through ACA and Compliance Professional Forum to get those recommendations as well and to see what kind of feedback those agencies can provide us.
And if they're nearby, sometimes you might be able to visit somebody where their technology is in that office and, you know, if they'll allow you to come on site, you know, to not necessarily kick the tires and stuff, but to see it actually in action. And, you know, not just at the management level, but see how maybe bring a lead employee who's actually going to use the software and, you know, if they'll let them sit down and just watch and observe in action, they can ask some questions. That's very helpful, especially on the larger ticket items.
Good tip. At this point, I just want to pause the discussion briefly, and I'd like to invite Linda Straub-Jones from LexisNexis Risk Solutions to say a few words. Linda?
Thanks so much, Mike, and hello, everyone. And thanks again to all of our panelists for participating and sharing your expertise today. So far, it's been really great. As many of you know, LexisNexis Risk Solutions supports the credit and collection industry through its comprehensive database of information on individuals and businesses. The information we compile comes from over 10,000 sources and enables us to provide access to over 280 million consumers and 48 million businesses. Our patented matching and linking technology, which we call LexID, assigns a unique and persistent identifier to each consumer, and this unique identifier powerfully connects consumer information maintained in those disparate data sources, providing a very comprehensive view of each consumer. Something you may not know is that LexisNexis also has a series of products that can help you with vendor risk management. We can help you identify the business, its representatives and associates, assess the related risk to each, and monitor for changes over the lifetime of the relationship. So if you'd like any information about our products, please feel free to contact me, linda.straub@lexisnexisrisk.com, or visit our website, risk.lexisnexis.com, and search for the keyword vendor risk. Thanks again, Mike.
Thank you, Linda, and thanks again to LexisNexis Risk Solutions for sponsoring today's webinar. You know, on behalf of everybody here and everybody in the ARM industry, thanks for helping promote such an important educational platform. Now, let's pick up with our discussion. I'm curious, we mentioned a little bit about sort of informing clients about updates that you're making to sort of make sure that, you know, they know you're working on providing better service and continuous improvement. When you're looking at or evaluating a service, you know, going through your due diligence process, we talked about referrals and references being very important. Do you include your clients at all in that process? Maybe Tracy, you can take that one first.
Sure. We certainly will check with clients if it's something that's very specific to one client that we're implementing and, you know, really have them partner with us along the way. Items that are specific to that the client might get involved with might be the statement vendor that you're using, a payment portal vendor. You know, have they had a previous relationship or any past experiences? You tend to get asked, you know, who your partners are in those areas, and we certainly share those. If we were going to make a change to a critical vendor like that, there are probably some client relationships that we would consult and have to take into consideration before making that decision. So I want to say, yes, there is client involvement to some degree, but then I'm also going to say, you know, if we were changing out our complete software system or our dialing system, we might ask certain clients that may have had experience with the ones that we're looking at changing to, but I'm not sure that large of a decision would necessarily be based solely on what clients would want, because there's so many clients that you really couldn't get check off or sign off from everybody. So I think it's more in a consultative way where appropriate versus having an absolute requirement by that client before you make a change.
And I'll agree with that. And I think it's client-specific and vendor-specific. For instance, if it's your collection software and they're used to having the ability to having client access to your system and they use it frequently, if you're going to change systems and the new system isn't going to have client access, or if you're going to need to get some integrated partner to give them client access, those are, you know, decisions you're going to have to weigh, because you're not going to want to make your client unhappy or cause any kind of dissatisfaction whatsoever if you move, because obviously there's somebody there waiting at their door ready to take the business if they are unhappy.
And that is true. Quite a few of our clients have access to our systems, just of course to their information. But also in our MSAs, some of our clients require us to let them know before we onboard any type of a vendor so they can approve it. In the 3 years I have been working with a vendor program at ERC, no one has ever denied it or declined. But if they did, we would have that conversation to figure out why they are, you know, have concerns about this vendor and try to resolve those issues. Unless they have a legitimate reason that they know, you know, something was going on with the vendor. But also what we do is we ensure the vendor is going to meet our client standards prior to onboarding and by reviewing the MSA and adding any required language before we execute that contract. So that way there's, you know, no doubt that our client requirements are going to get met. And we also do the onboarding process to make sure that they have the policies, certifications, licenses, insurance in place that we require. So we try to, you know, cover everything before we onboard those agencies. I'm sorry, those vendors.
So the letting the clients know, it tends to be more of a formality at this point, you would say?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Cool. We've talked a little bit about, we've started to delve into the process. I'm curious how extensive and comprehensive the process should be. You've talked about checking a lot of references, multiple people checking references. So it seems that, you know, there are components of this, or, you know, the process itself could take a long time. And I'm curious, if you have any thoughts as to how to sort of figure out how extensive and comprehensive the selection process should be for a new service provider. Is it relative to this, you know, the type of business? Is it relative to the size of the investment? Would love to get any insights. Maybe Paige, you can take that one first, if you don't mind.
Sure. So at ERC, the process is the executive management team and the ERC business owner work together. They're the ones who complete the references and do all the research and due diligence on the service level of that vendor. And once they narrow that down to one potential vendor, they notify the vendor management team. And what we do is we send out a due diligence package to that vendor that they need to complete. And it covers everything from their details about their company, licenses, insurance, their compliance program, training program, info security, any type of certifications they need. And we want them to complete that, us to review that information before we sign off on this vendor. And they might complete the information and we might have to follow up for a few things, but we'll talk that through with the ERC business owner and the executive management team. And then they will go and approve the contract, which we've already reviewed. And also our accounting department reviews for the payment terms and our legal department reviews for any type of legal information that is in there to make sure that everything's covered before that's onboarded. And then we all have to agree, yes, we approve this vendor to be onboarded.
Yeah, I'll just add that, I think it depends on how much money you're willing to sacrifice if you're going to make a mistake. So as far as the time and investment, I mean, we went to move our phone system. We were used to having a phone system on site, and a service provider was there if anything went wrong. You know, it was VoIP, but there was actually somebody in Tampa that could come and fix the phone system. And then several years ago, we vetted going to the cloud for a variety of reasons. But going to the cloud meant, you know, you didn't have the technology on site. It was in the cloud, and, you know, the companies in California or what have you. So you have to ask those questions. How is this going to be serviced? What kind of IT resources and stuff am I going to need on my end to troubleshoot if they need our resources, or can it all be done remotely? But, you know, that's a thorough vetting process, especially if your business relies on phones and phones and phones. Phone contact is, you know, what we do every day. So, it can be a scary thing. So you really want to vet it out.
And also you'll want to put that in your MSA as well, those type of service requirements, the help desk, and then a penalty if they cannot meet those requirements, if they agreed on them.
And Mike, I think you started out by asking, you know, does this process take a long time or a short time? And clearly Matt and Paige agree, and I do too, that, you know, take your time, right? Either way. And, you know, the larger the change, the longer the time it's most likely going to take to vet that. We would have any large changes outlined in our strategic plan and would have our leadership team involved in knowing that we're seeking out a new partner for a certain area. So your collection software, your phones, your statement vendors, maybe your HRIS system, accounting system, things of that nature. Other items that may take a shorter time might be testing a new scoring vendor or doing something different with a skip tracing process or vetting a add-on tool. So, you know, I think it can take a long or short time, but you still probably want to go through a questionnaire and a formal process either way. And we require an ROI document to be completed as part of what the operational or business person who's requesting this change, they fill it in. And that tells you, you know, not only how much money is going to be spent, but what value you're going to get out of making a change. And a lot of times you can get a very high level ROI before you even spend a lot of time and energy going through the very detailed process to know if it's a project that you want to spend time on or not.
And I think it's really, I know all these decisions are made, you know, at the executive level, but I think it's employee, it's especially important that when you do come down to making the change, you explain to the team, hey, this is what we're going to do, this is why we're going to do it, and this is how it's going to help you. Because it's really important at the end of the day, get everybody's buy-in at all levels. So, because, I mean, let's face it, change is scary, right?
I agree with that 100%.
I know I fear it on a daily basis, but that's just me. You know, Tracy, I wanted to go back to you know, talking about the process. You mentioned at the start, sort of giving people time if they have, you know, if they have something that they, you know, something new or something that might be better than what you're using now. How does that sort of fit in to the, you know, how does that conversation sort of fit in or become the process? You know, from that first conversation, you know, where does it kind of go from there?
Sure. Where there usually needs to be an owner, somebody who wants to go look for a new service provider or implement a new product because of, you know, something that is going to make our business better. So that owner will either use the innovation meeting process that we have, or for smaller items that are, you know, maybe on the opposite side of the calendar as the innovation meeting is, they will take that to their leadership and they'll fill in a return on investment document and give a, you know, a small overview of what the project would be. And then their leader needs to give them the thumbs up or not related to pursuing that product. We're willing a lot of times to try those recommendations that people make, especially when it comes to account management strategies. The ones that are larger picture decisions take more of our executive team approval. So we have a weekly meeting and those topics would be added to our executive team. The recommendations are made from our the leaders of our functional departments would make that recommendation to our executive team, and those would be reviewed weekly. And we'd give them, you know, hey, we need more information. Come do a presentation to us on, you know, why you think we should go forward with this process, or a thumbs up or thumbs down on that decision. So, you know, it really is, we want everyone empowered to bring those ideas forward, and then we run that through our reporting structure, and each layer really has an approval authority for what projects they can get started and which ones might need an executive approval, and as well as we have a purchase order process that gets followed. So depending on the cost of the change, it would have to follow that process.
I'm curious if you have any insights as to how that process might be applied at a smaller agency where they don't have that many levels to kind of go through. Would you think it's roughly the same process, just, you know, with fewer people involved?
I think so, because it's still, you know, somebody has an idea or they've talked to a vendor they're interested in, or they're trying to solve for a problem. So they want to do something differently than what they do today, or get a different service than what they get today. And that person has to talk to whoever the leader is in order to present their case, so to speak, which in our world requires an ROI. And it's not a complex ROI to get started. It's just to show that this is something that would be worth spending our time reviewing, and those leaders together would make that decision or present it to the owner of the organization, you know, whatever that appropriate approval process would be, given the size of the organization.
And let's face it, I mean, we're getting calls every day from different vendors, right? I mean, you have a dialer vendor, you have a phone system, you have, you know, what, all your systems are there, and you're getting calls. Somebody's, hey, let me give you a 15-minute demo on this. There has to be a reason to change. It has to be compelling. You have to have a need. You don't just change for the sake of price or something like that. So, you know, yeah, I appreciate the fact that you want to take up 15 minutes of my time, but, you know, I've got other stuff to do, and I don't really have the need right now. You know, keep me on your list, and I'm not ever saying I will never say no to change, but, you know, I just don't have time every day to look at your product and what your offerings are.
So, you know what, our innovation review meeting has been awesome for those kind of conversations, because the ones that I might want to look at some point, but it's just not top on the radar today, I am able to explain to them what our process is for reviewing new programs once a year, and then they have to get, you know, past that group, and they have to get added to the budget for the following year, and it helps me to explain, and then it level sets the conversation of what's the timeline when that salesperson should get back to me. But I also am upfront if it's just something that's way out there and not even, you know, worth my consideration or wouldn't even be on the radar at that point. I'm willing to tell them that as well, because you don't want to waste their time or yours, and you just want to be upfront.
Right.
Excellent. Well, at this point, we've got a couple of questions in the queue, and to get people maybe to ask a few more, I want to tackle these and give people a chance to type in their question if they have any. First question, do you recommend using your own MSA or using the one that the service provider has?
Without the vendors that we have, they have a standard MSA that they send us. I think we've had to create one MSA from ERC, but all of our vendors want to use their MSA. So that's when we have a very extensive review process. We have a checklist that has, I think, over 14 categories, and we make sure that that information is covered in the MSA. And if it's not, I have created standard language, because you're seeing the same things over. So I just drop that language in the MSA, redline it, and then we send it back to the vendor for approval, just to make sure that we have all of our stuff covered.
I agree. I think a lot of your national vendors, you know, they're going to want to start with their MSA, and then, you know, you redline it from there. And then your smaller, if it's a local vendor, something like that, you can either use your own or start with theirs. But, you know, the language may be, as far as applicability, you know, what it depends on the vendor and the nature of the vendor and their services and stuff. So we usually just start with theirs and go from there.
We do the same thing. We start with the service provider's agreement and redline from that.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Do any of the panelists utilize a data security standard survey questionnaire to ensure that potential new vendors are going to protect the agency's data?
Definitely. Yeah, that's part of our, go ahead, Tracy.
No, go ahead.
That's part of our onboarding due diligence. We have one tab that's dedicated to information security, privacy, their fourth party vendors, anything that's going to affect our information. We make sure that we get copies of their policies, certifications, evidence, that they're testing these items. So yes. And that's just for the, sorry, that's just for the vendors that have data or our data or can access our data. Now, if it's like the cleaning crew or something like that, we don't worry about the info security.
And we'll get, you know, depending on the vendor, obviously, if it's, you know, related to payment, you know, we're going to make sure they have, there's PCI compliance involved. They're following NASHA rules and regulations. If it's your own collection software, we're going to ask for, you know, to make sure they have the protections in place and what their certifications are and that they're maintaining, especially if it's cloud-based, because you don't have the control over it. So you're going to want to make sure you have that.
Excellent. Yes, and we
go ahead, Tracy.
Yeah, I was just going to add that we do provide, it's called a service provider security risk questionnaire that the provider needs to fill out and return back to us related to, you know, primarily data security and then some questions about access and network security confidentiality, some of those items.
Good. Next question, and then we'll move on to back to the discussion. What type of platforms are people using to help manage the workflow of this program and to keep files and et cetera organized?
Currently, we're using SharePoint.
We have migrated to SharePoint and are in the process of moving all of our documentation to that as well. But before SharePoint, we were just using our company network drives and folders storage system with access controls on the folders.
That's what we're doing as well, a company shared drive that is local that we can all access.
Oh, and we also use Trello and Microsoft Teams, and we use that as a checklist. So when we're onboarding a vendor, it has everything that needs to happen to onboard this vendor, and then we just check it, and it provides due dates that we'll email the auditor saying, okay, this is due on this date, so we can follow up with the vendor. And that's a really helpful tool. It's very easy, very simplistic, but you can easily look at it and see where you're at in the process and what step needs to happen next.
And Mike, I'll mention one thing too. You know, we in the state of Florida, the Office of Financial Regulation does random audits of agencies, and we had the luck and pleasure of being audited. I think it was 2 years ago. But the interesting thing was the shredding vendor. You know, it's important that you vet your shredding vendor to make sure, you know, that they're compliant, especially if you deal with medical data and stuff. You're going to want their certificates. Or certifications, and then you want to keep the certificates of destruction for exactly that reason. In the state of Florida, they're going to vet, or they're going to check your auditing process to make sure that, number one, is your shredding vendor, you know, compliant, and or is it, are they dumping the stuff in a trash bin that's going to end you up on the Channel 9 news or something like that? So that's just something to keep in mind. You want to thoroughly vet them and show that you've vetted them and have the proof to back that up in case you do get audited.
Yeah, not only the shredding companies, we also audit our security guards or the security guard company and the cleaning crew company because they have access to our floor. And we want to make sure that, you know, each one of those cleaning crew signs our NDA, our information security policy. So when they're on site, they have to abide by our policy. And we also we don't do the whole info security check, but we make sure that they have their background checks and that type of information.
Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. We've talked about a lot of different components of a due diligence process, but I'm curious, are there areas of due diligence that you think or you see are often overlooked when selecting a new service provider? You know, like, for example, I was a little surprised, I guess, at, you know, how important fit is. So I'm wondering if there are any areas that are overlooked when selecting a new service provider, Matt?
I think compliance needs are sometimes overlooked. I mean, like I mentioned, you know, we get solicitations from vendors, multiple kind of vendors, and that can provide a similar service. but they don't necessarily know the nuances of your industry, like dialer companies. You also want to know, you know, how well do they play in the sandbox with others? Meaning, you know, can they integrate with whom you want to bring to the table? Or are you going to be forced to use their vendors that are integrated with their system? For instance, if it's a collection software.
And like I said, we have a very extensive, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Tracy.
All right, I'll take this one and then you can go. I think it can be overlooked how that service provider understands your business. And so we like to have the service providers come to our office, take a tour, get to know us a little bit. And we really want to make sure that they're providing us the right solution that's a fit for our organization and how we might use their product or service. So I always want to make sure that they understand what we do, how we do it. And I think it'll tell you a lot about that partner based on how much time they're willing to commit getting to know your business. Go ahead, Paige.
Okay. Well, some of the things that we have overlooked, and again, we have an extensive questionnaire that has over 100 questions on our due diligence audit or questionnaire. But then we have clients that come in and audit us, and they're like, hey, what about this? You know, do you check this? And one of them was the, we do OFAC checks on our vendors, and we do an FTC band search, but they wanted to make sure that was in our vendors' background checks. That's something that we never thought of. So they will point out stuff that we will, you know, have to incorporate into our due diligence process and our annual audit.
And I'll just add to that too. I think sometimes things that get overlooked are, you know, you're wooed on the sale and you get the product or service, but then you find out you need this or you need that. You know, you got to think about things. Are you going to get nickel and dime for things that you're going to need after the sale or after you're on the service or whatever it is? And then other things are like, you know, what are the operational hours? If they're on the other side of the coast, and you're not in the same time zone, are they going to meet your operational requirements when you're in business and, you know, they're sleeping or whatever? And then, other things are like, are you going to be the guinea pig? Like if this is a new vendor and new to the industry, are you going to be the guinea pig? But this goes both ways. For instance, I don't want to sit back and lose an opportunity if I can get ahead on my competition. But I don't want to open Pandora's box and start getting sued left and right and lose my shirt. I'm going to give you an example. When TCPA came out and ringless voicemail came about with VoApps, you know, a lot of people were hesitant to use VoApps, but we saw a need that had to be met, which is contacting consumers. And, that met that need. But we thoroughly vetted that and looked at the compliance end piece of it. And, you know, as far as an agency, were, you know, kind of assured by the assurances we got as far as the way it worked and the technology it works. I realize that's, you know, a topic of contention. Some agencies say absolutely not, but it's something, you know, that's worked for us and it's something we didn't sit back and wait on. We just did our due diligence and then decided the return on the investment would be worth it. And it proved to be true.
Your comment on, you know, the sort of avoiding a situation where you're getting nickel and dimed is interesting. So is that just a function of making sure that you're covered in the agreement that you're signing, or are there other steps that an agency can do to make sure that they're not going to fall victim to that?
Yeah, well, I think it's a matter of, like, for instance, if it's a reporting need or something, you know, you need to make sure in the beginning, how is this going to happen if, you know, if we can't meet this need for my particular client that wants this particular report, you know, this time once a year or something, and, you know, you want to make sure, is your staff going to be able to do that? Or if the client's going to be able to do that quickly, and are they going to charge you for it? You know, that's just one of those things you just have to vet out early in the beginning and make sure it's covered and understood.
Right. One of the things that we found is really when you're negotiating a larger contract is to do the best you can to lock in future pricing. So it's all good, your pricing for your first term, whatever that is, 12 months, 24 months. But what does it look like when you need to renew? Because a lot of the service providers, they're giving just that a service. So it's not like when you go to the store and you buy something and then you have it and that's it. What happens at the end of 2 years when that contract's done and you go to renew, are they going to increase the price or not? So we try to lock in the current rates for as long as we can, or as long as we think we'll be utilizing the product or some protection around that, as well as expansion pricing. So we always like to build in what if the volume of our use of that service increases, how can we make that price go down in the contract over time? So we like to lock in future, and then once we grow, we should get a discount for that growth and additional volume that we're giving to that service provider.
And I know this was mentioned earlier, but it's really make sure that in your contract, you know how to get out of your contract if you need to. And, you know, if it's not in there, you know, it's the decision of they're going to need to change it to meet your needs to get you as a client, or, you know, you walk.
Tracy, do you find that most service providers are willing to sort of negotiate that pricing model you mentioned?
Yes. Yes, for certain, because, you know, they want you for a customer as long as possible. And usually, you know, you were willing to add on some time to the agreement in order to lock in that price or that discounted pricing. And so I think it helps both of us, but you have to be comfortable that you're going to be using that service, something that you need, and you're confident of that partnership to get into that kind of arrangement.
And another thing you can do in the MSA is state that they can only increase the price by a certain percentage point once the contract is up.
Good idea. One thing we haven't talked a lot about specifically, or they haven't really mentioned yet, is champion challenger tests. And I'm curious how important those fit into your selection process when you're evaluating and doing your due diligence on a new vendor. Is that something that you put a lot of stock in as well?
I think we're applicable. I think it's a great thing to do, especially for tools like scoring and skip tracing and insurance discovery. So when you can do that, whether you do a retroactive analysis or going forward, I think it's an excellent way to vet the vendor that you're potentially going to use and measure ROI.
Matt stole my response. Yeah, that's what we do here.
Sorry.
And you know what's been kind of a, maybe not a new term, but one that we've been using recently when we're not necessarily doing a champion challenger and we're just trying something brand new and we have nothing necessarily to directly compare to, is doing a pilot. So we're finding folks that are willing to do a sample, whether it's a paid pilot or not, to prove out the value of that service before you commit to a long-term contract. And that's one that we did with our gamification process, and we had a 90-day limited scope pilot before we made the longer term commitment.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And when you have a vendor that's willing to do that without committing to a full year contract, I think that's an excellent way to go.
So just to clarify, I wanted to follow up, Matt, on something on which you originally said. It only, Champion Challenger really only works in certain areas. It's not something that can be used across the board.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you can't champion challenge one collection software against another because you're not going to implement them both and use them for a period. I mean, it would be way too much work. But for something like skip tracing, scoring, insurance discovery, you know, things like that, where there's many vendors and they're all willing to do that champion challenger with you to win your business and or prove that they're better than the competition, you know, certainly want to apply that where it can, where you can.
Got it. Okay. We've just got a few minutes left and we do have a couple more questions that have come into the queue. So this is one of the final offer a final reminder to anybody who has a question for Tracy, Paige, or Matt, now's the time to type it in and we'll try to get to it before the webinar is over. The question, if your vendors have access to client data, how often are you going on site to audit them?
A lot of ours are in the cloud, so we're not, Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm sorry. We rank our vendors, and if they are a critical vendor, they have access to everything. We go and it used to be annually, but now we do it every 2 years. But we do a remote audit annually on them.
I was going to say, you know, the online.
Sorry. Go ahead, Matt.
No, I agree with that because, you know, the practicality of, you know, going to your dialer vendor and auditing, you're going to do everything remotely as far as, you know, any audits that you're going to do.
Yes, and that's the same with us. We do conduct audits. The majority are done remotely as well. And one step beyond that, just having routine business or partnership meetings with your top vendors is important. I know that's not the same as an audit, but I wanted to squeeze that in here, Mike, because we learn a lot through those partnership conversations that we have a couple times a year with our top vendors. And we talk about their roadmaps for future product development, things that they're seeing in the industry, and just different ways that we can use their technology or services. So just that constant communication with the partner is important, and it might even help keep you out of having to do a due diligence process because you'll learn something new about the partner you already have.
That's just like a marriage.
Oh my.
A question here coming in about vendor business associate agreements, specifically for those in healthcare, for certain services like shredding or cleaning. Do you use those as opposed to a non-disclosure agreement?
We use both depending on the vendor. For instance, if it's a shredding vendor, we're going to have a BAA. If it's a cleaning crew, we're going to have a BAA, but they're not going to necessarily access the data. So we won't have a non-disclosure agreement because they're not, you know, the BAA should cover it for that purposes. But I think it just depends on the vendor.
That's the same for us.
Okay. We've talked a little bit about this. It's kind of come up during the course of a couple of the answers, but I'm just curious, you know, looking at an agent, you know, agencies of different shapes and sizes, who would you say should be in charge of the process for, you know, for due diligence and evaluating new service providers?
I think that's really, you know, it's a function of management. It's just a matter of who's going to take on that task and that duty. Obviously, compliance should be involved to some extent, but whether it's the executive team or, you know, a director or something like that, it just depends on the size and structure of your agency and who's going to take on that responsibility. Usually it's going to be somebody obviously in operations because that's where most things have the most impact. But, you know, if it's HR functionality or something like that, it's going to be a different department.
I agree. What we do is we have it separated. So it is the business owner and the SVP of that department is responsible for managing the SLAs to whatever requirements. So if it's the dialer, our SVP of dialer and the manager are responsible to make sure that that vendor is within SLA. If they're not, they notify the vendor management team. We have an email distribution list, and we track all the issues that that team has. And then quarterly, we reach out to all the different business owners and say, hey, where are we at with this vendor? You know, this is what we scored them as last month, where it was a low, where we had no concerns. Is there anything that we haven't tried? And they will give us an update on that. So they're responsible for that side of it. And then compliance, our internal audit, the vendor management team is responsible for the annual review or the annual audits and the management of the documents like the MSAs and the certificates and the insurance and anything like that. We're responsible for the review of the MSA. So it's kind of split. So the business owner and the executive management team is responsible for the processes that the vendor is doing for us, and we're responsible for the management of the documents and the actual compliance auditing every year.
Uh, We also have the business owner be responsible for that service provider, but then there's many components of the arrangement. The security piece is handled by our CTO, the compliance piece by the in-house counsel, and sometimes we'll bring in a project manager to coordinate all of the efforts and just schedule meetings or conference calls, webinars, demos, if that's necessary as well.
Excellent. Well, we've just about reached the top of the hour, but before I let everybody go, what I'd like to do is go around the panel and maybe give each of you the chance to offer any summary of what you've discussed today, anything you wanted to add but maybe didn't get a chance to, any parting words of wisdom, any final thoughts, any jokes you want to share, anything like that, before we wrap up. Paige, maybe we could start with you.
Okay, I would like to discuss the risk criticality that I spoke about earlier, where we do on-sites for critical offenders, mm-hmm. and we rank them as critical, high, medium, or low. And what we do is when the business owner sends us a vendor saying, hey, this is a potential vendor, we send them a spreadsheet, and it has the access to information, the number of records the vendor will have access to, will they have consumer contact, what's the importance of the data that the vendor's going to supply, and their BCP criticality. And then we give them five options, and they rank it either 10, 5, 3, 1, or 0. And so that's how we come up with our definition, our criticality. So there's no guessing. So like records of accessible, is it 75% to 100%? Is it 50% to 74.99%? So there's no guesswork. They can just provide that information to us, and that gives us our criticality.
Very interesting. Thanks. Matt?
I would just say, especially for the big ticket items, you really want to get buy-in. I mean, not just your executive team and, the management team in general, but you want the employees to really understand you're about to make a change. Yes, it's going to affect them. And just get their buy-in and explain, communicate often what the changes are. And then more importantly, once you implement, make sure that through the implementation phase and thereafter, they're communicating the things they're seeing, experiencing, so that you can either jump on a fire right away and put the fire out. But clear communication, bi-directional communication, I think is especially important for big ticket items.
Very good advice. Tracy, you get the last word today.
Okay, very good. I think it's all about the deliverables and the timelines. And if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. I would make sure that you outline what you're expecting from the new service provider, when you're expecting it by, and work together on that. And, be aware if you're putting an unreasonable expectation on the project and, really listen to that service provider because they've been through this with many others. And you always think you're the expert, but sometimes you're not, and you need to listen to others. So I would just say, keep your ears open during the process.
Excellent. Good advice. Well, Tracy, Matt, Page, thank you very much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time and your insights. This has been a really insightful conversation. So thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And again, thanks to LexisNexis Risk Solutions for sponsoring today's webinar. As Linda said, go to risk.lexisnexis.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. A recording of this event will be posted to accountsrecovery.net in the coming days. And please stay tuned to the site for more news and webinars in the very near future. I hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day. Thanks.
Thank you.